BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. How come Norwegian intelligence didn't notice when the country's main far-right terror suspect bought fertiliser needed for explosives? An exclusive report from Norway on far-right Masonic terrorist Anders Behring Breivik, the man behind this August's Oslo bombing, which killed 8 and seriously injured 10 at the subsequent island massacre. That was the actual bomb in Oslo. At the subsequent island massacres, where a further 69 young Norwegian Labour Party members on summer camp were executed and 66 seriously injured. The British Constitution in the crosshairs this week as our MPs yet again deny us a referendum on Europe. We talked to a constitutional campaigner, and after a wannabe politician failed in 1997 to become a Conservative candidate in Stafford, our guest Dave Barmby helped him in 2001 to become the candidate for Witney in Oxfordshire. The rest is history. The eventually successful candidate is now familiar to us all, none other than Prime Minister David Cameron. Martin Summers rounds up the international stories of the week for us, and as part of our Halloween politics special, sticking with Call Me Dave, his and Boris Johnson's and George Osborne's Bullingdon Club. How come so many members make it to positions of power? Plus, we return to take another look at an invite-only leadership charity Common Purpose at the council, the BBC and the police and other public services. Do some of their so-called graduates have their fingers in the till, placing orders for more training from Common Purpose? Or is it their cause so good it's public money well spent? And finally, on the day changes to the accession to the throne were announced, we hear from a Jewish author, former of the US Navy, Tim Cohen, all about what he believes are corrupt orders of knighthood here in Britain, with links that have been secretly tightening their grip on power for centuries. A Halloween story indeed, and not for the faint-hearted. So first, we go to Norway, where back in August, the man who came to Britain in 2002 to put his signature to the founding document of something called the New Knights Templar killed 77 and seriously injured 76 of his fellow countrymen. Like Dunblane killer Thomas Hamilton, who shot dead 16 schoolchildren in 1996, Anders Breivik was a Freemason and well known to the authorities. So why did they not act when he first attempted to buy explosives abroad and failed, and then brought a vast quantity of fertiliser in Norway to make his bomb, which was subsequently exploded right outside the government offices in Oslo? As the weeks and months have passed, Norwegian researcher Torstein Vidal has been keeping track of bits and pieces of news about the attacks as they've come out in the Norwegian press, and has pieced together some disturbing conclusions about the Breivik massacre and possibly complicity from within the Norwegian authorities.
I'm Torstein Vidal. I'm a secretary for 9/11 Truth Norway. And I got interested in Anders Behring Breivik because his bomb actually blew up my living room window.
Because there was two episodes, really, weren't there? There was first of all a big bomb in Oslo, and then he went off to an island, then conducted a massacre. So what for you are the things that we really should know about the Breivik massacre in Norway that maybe didn't come out at the time, that had just sort of filtered out over the weeks since then?
Yeah. Police has been very, very tight with their information, so we have gotten little by little something that resembles the truth after a while. And the very strange thing is all the things that the police didn't do. They didn't close the main roads out of Oslo in case there was another terror attack. They didn't put police and military helicopters up in the air after the bomb, which would be natural in case there was another situation. They didn't close the subway in Oslo for many hours, and they didn't close the national borders, and they didn't close the airports. I have a friend who took a plane to Iceland a couple of hours later. So that's all the things I didn't do in the city center. And then you have this red rubber dinghy boat that the police tried to cross the fjord with from a distant island, not from Utvika to Utøya, which is 600 meters. They drove 3.5 kilometers north and then had to take a sea journey for 3.5 kilometers back.
Can you just tell us your experience when the bomb actually went off?
Yeah, I live in downtown Oslo. So in my apartment, I heard something that sounded like thunder. So I thought it was the lightning. And then my window flew open, and then I went on the internet and said, wow, that was some pretty close lightning. It sounded exactly like that. And then I got back from another person that there is a message about an explosion. So I took my camera and ran further downtown to document, you know, all the broken windows and everything. So, yeah.
So much news came out just literally on the day and the weekend. But that isn't the whole picture.
No, absolutely not. It took more than a month before police admitted they had had a five-day terror drill ending on Friday the 22nd.
That's the same day as these attacks.
At 3 o'clock. So 15 minutes after the drill officially ended, we don't know if that's true, Anders placed his car next to the Prime Minister's office, right? And he walked away with a police uniform and a helmet and a gun in his hand. And the security people thought nothing of it. Huh. So that's very strange.
What evidence is there for this drill then?
Norway's biggest paper wrote about it from an anonymous police source. So they probably know this source, you know. But the strange thing is that there has been some kind of gag order on this terror drill story. Because after August 26th, when the story broke the first time, nobody has mentioned that in the mainstream media after.
Well, what's the significance then of a drill?
It's significant because there is some peculiar coincidence that London had a drill on the same three tube stations on 7-7 in 2005, and also America had several terror drills involving planes flying into buildings even on 9-11. So it seems very strange that there should be a massacre terror drill scenario on the same day, even the same hour, on the 22nd.
Now, what about evidence to do with Anders Breivik himself? Do you think it's proven that he really did work alone? Because that's certainly what we were told at the time.
It seems he was maybe the only shooter on the island, judging all the evidence for that. But one shouldn't rule out that there may have been complicit elements from within the security apparatus or, you know, the police department. Yeah, actually, the Secret Service in Norway got from European or global terror institutions, they got an advice about Breivik because he had bought some explosive materials, but they decided not to follow up. That was in March or April, I think.
The Norwegian police, since the attacks, have been over to Britain to interview certain far-right people here. What do you know about that?
I read from the website document.no, which is a far-right pro-Israel website, that Anders had been complicit in constructing the ideological fundament for English Defence League and Norwegian Defence League. So he's been participating in finding out what kind of group they were supposed to be and what kind of values they were supposed to fight for. And
are there any other aspects to the massacre in Norway that you think we should bring to the audience's attention?
When it comes to the bomb in downtown Oslo, I think that was part of the plan to make the police focus on that thing while he was doing something else and killing far more people another place.
So this is one of the first times we've seen that a terrorist is quite clearly there on the TV at the time in his Masonic regalia.
Yeah, it's not the first time, because if you remember the NATO Operation Gladio in Italy, you had the P2 Lodge, which was a Freemason lodge, and they were right-extreme people posing as communists because the communists were supposed to be the bad guys, and the government didn't want people to vote for the communists. So they blew up train stations and killed 80 people in Bologna's train station, trying to blame it on the communists. That was Freemasons and NATO in concert, yeah.
What is Gladio, and how does this relate to the Norwegian attack?
It's pretty obvious that this is a crime against democracy in some way, because you attack a youth political organization and also the Prime Minister's office. And maybe it is possible that some part of the security state inside Norway or in Europe or even wider wanted to teach Norwegian politicians a lesson about not being that free about forming their opinions about the Middle East or something. We have had local elections in September, and then of course there was a sympathy wave for the Labour Party, and they got far more votes, and also the far right Progress Party went down or behind. Those are the obvious short-term effects, and no one knows how the long-term effects will be. Maybe the main aim is to change the politics of the Labour Party.
And can you just tell us a bit about Norway? Because you're not in the European Union, are you?
Yeah, we are practically in the European Union because of some dodgy deal between Gro Harlem Brundtland and Jacques Delors of the EU Commission. So for all practical purposes, we are a member of the European Union. But no, it's not very different. It's pretty similar to these systems in the UK and the continent. But the main difference, I think, is with the economy, because we have so much oil money. So even unemployed people are pretty well off, you know. So come to Norway.
Well, that was Torstein Vidal talking about the attack by Anders Behring Breivik back in August this year. Now, Martin Summers, you're still with me, old Labour Oxford economist. Your take on this exercise business, because it's the first I'd actually heard that there was a massacre exercise being conducted in Norway, actually on the same day, that finished just about the same time as this attack began. What is the significance of this exercise, do you think?
Well, as Torstein pointed out, similar exercises were being carried out on the London Underground on the same day which as 7/7 in 2005. And lots of exercises were going on in the United States on 9/11, including of planes crashing into buildings. Now, he mentioned Gladio there. That was a NATO structure. This is not conspiracy theory. There have been... There's been parliamentary investigations in Italy, Switzerland and Belgium, which has definitely included that NATO intelligence services were involved in creating terrorist incidents in which lots of ordinary people were killed in order to create political effects. Nobody's been punished for any of this, by the way, but it's actually on the record that this is what's happened. He mentioned one of the worst attacks, the bombing of Bologna railway station in 1980, but it began in Italy, the bombing in Piazza Fontana in 1969, the shootings in Belgium in the 1980s, the so-called Brabant massacres, which most people in Britain haven't heard about, and of course there was a bombing in Dortmund in Germany at the beer festival, all run by NATO secret services and the secret networks that they'd set up.
But what was the purpose of
that operation? Of this is to try and steer public opinion in certain kinds of directions. So what Torstein was saying there was that the actual political effect, just after the Madrid bombing, for example, Zapatero and the socialists did rather well. And I think that was not actually what the intended effect of those bombs were, if they were Gladio-style bombs. But, I mean, basically, Norway has actually pursued a rather independent line, both in relation to the EU and in relation to foreign policy, and has had a very progressive internal policy for many years that the unemployed are looked after, as Torstein pointed out. Some people don't like that, so Norway has to be punished. Now, I don't really know, we've got to look more into this, but the suspicion that he didn't act alone and that some hidden hand is behind it, probably in the Western intelligence services, is a perfectly rational guess.
So,
and if I was a Norwegian policeman, that's the first thing I'd be thinking.
So Breivik has his fingerprints on the founding documents of the English Defence League and the Norwegian Defence League. Surely the Norwegian authorities would not have let him build a bomb, a massive bomb.
Well, who knows? I mean, the problem, the way this stuff works is that all of these things are deniable. So the English Defence League, for example, and Al-Majid Haroon, the English Defence League was set up because Al-Majid Haroon came and protested against the Royal Anglian Regiment in Luton. And in Italy in the 70s, you had the fascist terrorists and the communists, so-called communist terrorists, the Red Brigades, Prima Linea and so on, all of which were being manipulated by the intelligence services to frighten the population into line. And we've got people being put on trial, top generals being put on trial in Turkey at the moment, they're part of NATO, for their part in similar attacks inside Turkey.
This is the Ergenekon
network.
Ergenekon trial.
Ergenekon trial. Ergenekon is the Turkish version of Gladio. Now, people can check this for themselves very easily. Just put in a search on your computer to Gladio, G-L-A-D-I-O, and you will find enormous amounts of material about Western intelligence service terrorism. And people in the comfortable parts of Britain say, oh, but our Western intelligence services don't engage in terrorism. I say, wake up and smell the cordite.
So, finally, what do you make of the British connection here? Because Breivik was actually over in 2002 here in Britain, sitting down with some people drawing up, again, a similar kind of document to this English Defence League with something called the New Knights Templar.
Well, I think this is a case for Wallander, don't you? let's get some of these serious Scandinavian detectives on the case, eh?
Okay, British Constitution at Dave Barnby and Albert Burgess after some music.
Some people say a man is made out of mud. A poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood and skin and bones. A mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning when the sun didn't shine. I picked up my shovel and I walked to the mine. I loaded 16 tons, a number 9 coal. And the straw boss said, well, bless my soul, you load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. I was born one morning, it was drizzling rain. Fighting and trouble are my middle name. I was raised in the canebrake by an old mama lion. Can't know a high-toned woman make me walk the line. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store. If you see me coming, better step aside. A lot of men didn't, a lot of men died. One fist of iron, the other of steel. If the right one don't get you, then the left one will. You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
From an album entitled Top 10 Hits of the 1950s, that's Tennessee Ernie Ford. And it wasn't just a top 10 hit, it was actually number one, sometime anyway, in the UK in the 1950s. Now, the British Constitution is in the crosshairs this week, and this has been, as our MPs yet again deny us a referendum on Europe. So we talked to a constitutional campaigner, and also to, that's Albert Burgess, and also to Dave Barnby. And we're going to start by talking to Dave, because Dave, the thing that fascinates me more than anything almost about you is the fact that you were actually you were keeping quite an eye on this debate that went on earlier in the week, because you knew David Cameron, didn't you, when he first became, I think it was, in it 2001 when he first stood to be an MP?
No, it was 2000, the year 2000, March 2000. He came to my house seeking support for his PPC-ship.
Because he'd actually failed, I didn't realise this, in Rochdale in the previous election in 1997.
Well, that doesn't really mean much, because they always bring in young chaps to try them out on a unsafe seat, and of course that were the 2001 election was the one where he was supposed to win it, you see, because it was a safe Conservative seat.
So how have his politics changed over the years? When you first met him, have you found that the Prime Minister we now have has got a similar kind of manifesto, similar ideas to what he had when you knew him?
Well, I would say, I mean, he came to my house seeking my support. The management of the Conservative Party, I was in the Conservative Party at that time, I'm not now, he was seeking my support because the management of the local Conservative Party wanted Andrew Mitchell. Andrew Mitchell had lost his seat in 1997, and was seeking to get back into Parliament, which he succeeded in doing in the same election, but he had to go and get a seat somewhere else.
But obviously, as a young wannabe MP, he would have to really sell himself to the local constituency party in Witney, and I'm interested in how he did that.
Well, I think he was quite personable. He's a very good PR man, and he comes across very well. I went to the selection meeting where there were 1,000 Conservative members or so, There was David Cameron, there was Andrew Mitchell, and some other lady whose name I forget. And of course, David Cameron's speech was the best, but the management of the local Conservatives were batting for Andrew Mitchell.
So is it done by a show of hands then, just in a meeting with your local members?
Proper ballot to the members, and he came out.
But it was a sort of hustings to be the prospective parliamentary candidate.
That's right. And the surprising thing was that after David got David Cameron got selected, won the vote, the management committee had arranged for a big sort of banquet for him to go, for him and Samantha to go to afterwards and celebrate his the victory, so to speak. The funny thing was, after the vote had been held and he'd been acclaimed the new PPC for Witney, he disappeared. And the chairman of the party came to me and said, David Cameron's gone, along with Samantha. He's gone off with Grant Stanley, a 22-year-old local councillor. And what had happened is Grant Stanley had arranged beforehand that they would go down to the local pub and celebrate, the three of them. And, of course, the whole committee were a bit...
They put on a party and David didn't turn up. Anyway, we're also joined by Albert Burgess. And David, maybe you could introduce Albert by way of explaining this about this book that you've published.
Just before we get on to that, you did announce that it was about the British Constitution. There is no British Constitution. Some people might argue about it, but they're onto hiding to nothing. This book is called The Layman's Guide to the English Constitution. And I'll give you a copy, so you've got it handy there. This came about because I met Albert back in 2006, I think it was, and he got interested in some of the researches I was doing, and I'd researched into how we got into the EU, how Ted Heath had used the civil service and Uncle Tom Cobbley and all to con the people into the European Union back in the early 70s. And Albert got very interested in the CD. And
when you say con, what you really mean is that we signed up for something called the EEC, and what we got was a much more political type of union.
That. I mean, there was would say it was a treasonable campaign. If you look at the CD shoehorned at the EU, all the documents are on there to show it. So I say it was a con. They used it was a massive campaign, massive money from everywhere. All the media was co-opted into it. Anyway, Albert saw this, and this set him going into various directions, and one of these was looking into the English Constitution. So he's researched it.
Okay, so Albert, what is the English Constitution?
Well, the English Constitution is actually very old. The first ever book of English constitutional law was actually issued by Alfred the Great.
He was a local boy, wasn't he? In fact, down just about 50 miles south of here.
Yeah. Anyway, he went round all of the old kingdoms, which comprised his kingdoms, picked the best laws and customs from each kingdom, and wrote them in a book of law called the Dome. He then showed that to the Witan and asked them, is this good law? And they approved it.
Can you just explain, what was the Witan? That was a kind
of
Witan meeting.
It's like his advisors,
right.
Like what probably would be today the Privy Council. And he, in fact, showed it to them, asked them, was this good law? And they said yes. So it was then promulgated throughout the whole of England, Alfred's kingdom, as the law of England, the King's Law. It was the first ever book of King's Law issued.
But you're saying that this is actually the first one, but hang on a minute. I mean, we've had loads and loads of statute law since then, which surely wipes that out, doesn't it?
No, it doesn't. Because basically, we have throughout our history a series of laws which have gone on. Now, William the Conqueror, when he killed King Harold, he actually said that he was going to keep the laws of Edward the Confessor, which was actually Alfred the Great's law. His second son, Henry I, he was made to issue a thing called the Charter of Liberties of 1100, which was in fact a reissue of Alfred's law. Magna Carta of 1215 was actually a reissue of the Charter of Liberties of 1100. Virtually word for word the same document, and Archbishop Langton had found a copy of the Charter of Liberties, which he then showed to the barons prior to the Magna Carta being signed.
But I hate to disappoint you, Albert, but this is ancient history, and actually what's really going on out there is something completely different,
well,
which is statute law mostly,
well,
is what being enacted through our court system.
But
so why is that?
Basically, we have a great deal of constitutional law, and constitutional law is higher law, and statute law cannot repeal by implied repeal a constitutional law.
So what you're saying is these laws have been laid down, but actually they're not valid because of this.
They're not valid. And let me give you an example. The Bill of Rights of 1689, which David Cameron's talking about amending with regard to the succession, he can't. It's high treason to even contemplate that. But I mean, that particular law says that you cannot be imprisoned unless you have been found guilty in a court of law. And that is a constitutional concept. It's a constitutional law. And yet the Anti-Terrorism Act says that you can be detained for 28 days without any evidence being presented to anybody, just because a government minister says, I don't like this person, I think they are a threat to the state, and he's not then asked to supply any evidence to substantiate that. So the anti-terrorism law is actually a bad law, because it actually contravenes the Bill of Rights. And according to Chief Justice Beresford, who was Chief Justice to Edward II, there is no such thing as a bad law, for if it is bad, it is not law.
Yeah, but so the trouble is, Albert, I keep coming back to this point, is that actually this stuff is not being enacted through our courts. So if you wanted to sort of pick up Alfred the Great's laws and wave it in front of the judge, he's just going to ignore you.
Well, no, he shouldn't do.
But this is the practicality of it.
But the reason is that this is being done, and the politicians are getting away with this, is because for the past 50 or 60 years, our constitution has not been taught. It's not taught in schools. It's not taught in law schools. And police officers are certainly not taught about constitutional or common law. They're taught how to give you a parking ticket or a speeding ticket or something like that.
Can you just explain then what is common law? Because this is a term we hear quite a lot, isn't it?
Well, common law basically is law which is... it's where the law has been defined by the courts. So Alfred the Great produced his Book of Law, and then as a result of various court cases, they've actually taken all the rough edges off of Alfred the Great's law and tidied it up. That becomes a common law. Now, custom, lots of our common law, in fact, all our common law is custom. And custom is a law which has been around with the approval of the people from times of greatest antiquity. Now, Sir Edward Coke, in 1628, he was our Chief Justice, he actually said that any law outside of living memory was custom, and he put the date of living memory at 1199. So if you take 1199 off 1628, you're talking roughly 400 years. So any law which is more than 400 years old is the custom and practice of England, and is beyond the reach of Parliament.
But this doesn't actually practically work, does it? I mean, we had a guy called Colin, this is about 18 months, come in here and talk about some of this stuff, and the next week he was due to come on and speak, but actually he'd been arrested, and he wasn't able to come in on the show. So it's all very well to talk about this, but practically it's not actually going to help you in the court.
Well, I get so many people telling me that they've been to court and they've lost their case because of corrupt judges. And I think that in a lot of cases, it's got nothing to do with a corrupt judge or a corrupt court. It's got to do with the fact that they present their cases badly. And if they present their cases badly, then they're not going to hope to win. However, if they arrested me and put me in front of a court, because of the knowledge that I have of the English constitutional law, I would present the case very well. And I suspect that the judges would be forced, by virtue of the fact that they can't argue with constitutional law, to come down on my side.
What about a test case then? Have you actually had a go at this and tried it out?
Well, what we're trying to do at the moment is we're trying to get people all over the country to report the surviving members of the Heath government and the civil service to the police for the crime of a conspiracy to commit treason. Because what Edward Heath did was he set up a conspiracy which met at the Connaught Hotel in London, which was attended by government ministers, members of parliament, the British Council for the European Movement, and the heads and senior people from all of the main media outlets, where they actually persuaded them to dump all of their frontline anti-EEC reporters, replace them with pro-EEC reporters. Not content with completely slanting the media, they then set up a department within a department within the Foreign Office who produced thousands upon thousands of letters, which were then sent to the central offices of the Labour Party, the Tory Party, the Liberal Party and the BCEM, who got them signed, sent off to the papers as though they came from Joe Bloggs in the street, and each of these letters was saying what a wonderful idea this EEC is and we've got to join ASAP. Every one of these letters was in fact written by the Foreign Office.
But I mean, have you actually tried reporting this and maybe taken a private prosecution or something?
Well,
that seems the obvious thing to do.
No, private prosecutions are not practical. They cost far more money than I have. If I sold my house, my car and the children, I still wouldn't have enough money to run a private prosecution this big. So what I'm doing is I'm running a campaign. I talk across all over the country. In fact, I was talked yesterday in Canterbury. And what I do is I say to people, I want you to take a part of the fight back. I want you to take this information which we are supplying, and what I want you to do is print it all up, go into your local police station and say, I want to report a crime. Now, so far, it's been reported in over 70 police stations nationally, including Gordon Brown's own constituency, I might add, and that was when he was Prime Minister. And what then happens is that the police then go through a blocking process.
Well, yeah, but hang on a minute. How can you prosecute Ted Heath? He's dead.
No, you're not talking about prosecuting Ted Heath. You're talking about people who worked with Ted Heath who are still alive. Douglas Hurd, St John Stevens, an awful lot of civil servants. So what the crime is not that Ted Heath, the allegation is not that Ted Heath committed treason, although he did, because he is dead, so it's pointless making that allegation. But there were a lot of people who worked with him, who were involved with him, and what you do is the allegation is that these people conspired with Ted Heath to commit treason by handing this country over to a foreign power, and that they, in order to do that, they set about subverting the constitution, which is the major crime of sedition, which at that level is high treason.
So actually ultimately that hasn't happened, but what you're trying to do is to get the word out about this. Dave, you've published this book. Can you tell us why you've decided to pick up this sort of particular gauntlet as someone that used to rub shoulders with our present Prime Minister?
Well, Albert produced something off his computer, off his printer. It was a bit, it was quite good, but the wording needed changing a bit, and a few things added, a few ideas I had of my own. So when Albert gave me his printed copy from his printer, I said to Albert, I said, this is really good. It needs publishing properly through a proper press. And so Albert sent me the text from his computer, and I did a bit of work on it myself, brushing it up, and uploaded it to Lulu. I don't know if you've heard of Lulu, but this is a self-printing company. You can print off one or two, or as few or as many as you want. And we then had the business of trying to publicise it, so it's now in.
But
the
shops. On the back here, yeah. It says England is still ruled by Alfred the Great through the laws he gave us. But I mean, practically speaking, surely that's just simply not happening.
Well, this is where Albert will have to come in again on that, because what Albert is saying is the laws we have, the constitution we have today, is still valid. It derives from Alfred the Great and before that time. And there's been other constitutional laws that have been added to, like the Bill of Rights, Declaration of Rights, Bill of Rights.
Albert, people may accuse you of simply living in the past here and living almost in cloud cuckoo land, because these other laws are the ones which are actually operative in our courts right now.
Well, I think you need to decide yourself whether you want to live under the rule of law or not. And if you want to live under the rule of law, that includes all law. And the constitutional law of this country is extremely good. In fact, most of the countries around the world have accepted our constitution, like the Americans, the Canadians, the Australians, and they've based their constitutional laws on it, because it is so good. And what it does is the English constitution guarantees our basic rights and freedoms. A lot of the statute law that's coming in is made by politicians who do not understand constitutional law. And in fact, one of our greatest ever judges Sir Matthew Hale, who's arguably the greatest judge we've ever had, he complained that politicians constantly pass bad law because they don't understand the Constitution and the common law. And because they pass bad law, the courts were constantly having to throw it out because it contravened the constitutional and common law. Now, for the last 50 or 60 years, as I said, our constitutional and common law have not been taught to our court, in our law schools, so our judges are not educated in it. Now, if the judges are not educated in it, that means they're not going to refer to it. When a case goes before the judge, he can only hear the case on the law that's presented to him. However, if we can get the police off their backsides into actually doing the job we pay them to, which is actually to uphold the law of this country the way it is actually written, and they prosecute people like Douglas Hurd for high treason, for conspiracy to commit high treason, I'm told by a senior police officer that they could get a conviction on the evidence we've supplied, but they don't want to do that, because if they do that, it will mean going out and arresting every government minister for the last 35, 40 years and charging them with treason, and that they're not prepared to do.
Now, old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, I'm going to bring you in here, because this is a bit of a dilemma. It sounds like what Albert's talking about here, and Dave, in this book, The Layman's Guide to the English Constitution, is actually two competing ideas of what the law is.
Well, I'm not a legal expert, so I can't argue with some of the legal points that have been made. I do think that British or English common law is very ancient. I mean, think of things like the jury system, for example, clearly existed a long way back. I mean, that was incorporated in Magna Carta, was it not? And the jury system is still retains a very important, and has always been a very important historical factor in Britain, because of course it means that people, the state wants to be prosecuted. You know, John Lilburn in this run up to the Civil War and so on, the jury is empowered to say we don't think you should prosecute this person, because the jury decides, the jury decides whether they're guilty or not guilty.
Yeah.
And all of this stuff is very ancient. But what my feeling is that our society has evolved over hundreds of years from these very important precedents. But of course, most of the laws we live under were created since the 19th century. The law was very simple until the 19th century. Then lots of new things came along, like factories and so on. So you had 8-hour day laws and so on. That kind of thing was not necessary before, because it wasn't really appropriate. So I think there is a continuity in law, clearly. There's a continuity, but I think you're going to have a hard job convincing modern courts that the law as of you know 650 or whatever, 850 or whatever, is going to supersede the Road Traffic Act of 2007 or whatever it is that they think it's about. There's clearly continuity, but there's also change, is what I would stress.
Yeah. Okay, and the book is called The Layman's Guide to the English Constitution. The author is Albert Burgess, and it's published by Dave Barmby. Just one final question, Albert. You've got a police badge on your blazer there. It looks like a police badge anyway. Why is that?
Well, because I spent 12 years as a police officer.
Whereabouts?
I did 10 years in London, where I worked 5 years on the red light district at King's Cross as a home beat officer, which was great fun. And then I spent 5 years in Harlesden on Kilburn Division, which is where you've got the two of the worst estates in London, Church End and Stonebridge Park Estates, which is mainly street crime and drugs, which was also good fun. And then for my last 2 years, I transferred to Thames Valley Police, which frankly was completely boring because nothing ever happened.
Okay, so just a final reminder, The Layman's Guide, it's called, to the English Constitution, by Albert Burgess. And Dave, what's the price?
We have two versions of it. We have a deluxe version, which is glossy paper, and the pictures in it is very well illustrated. Have a much higher resolution. They come at £6, and the standard version, which is for the same information, but a lower quality paper, is £3.
So you've given me the lower quality one. I'm so disappointed.
No, you've got the...
Oh, have I? Sorry.
No, sorry.
The super high quality one. Okay.
The
they are rather good, actually.
They
all
are
right.
Really
so
good.
I shall have a look at this, and it's been lovely talking to both of you.
Can I just add one thing? Yeah, that it's available if you go online and and Google Layman's Guide to the English Constitution, and you'll see there's many outlets for it. Thank you.
And use your favourite search engine, not necessarily Google. Albert, last word to you.
Yeah. Our friend here was talking about the fact that the laws are sort of old and been replaced by the statute law. Can I point out that under English law, there is no concept of obsolescence as a law. As long as a law is doing the job it is there to do, then in fact it is kept on the statute books. It doesn't suit our politicians to do that, because they want to do things which break the law all the time, as indeed David Cameron is doing today with the succession to the Crown. What he's doing today justifies his arrest and charging with high treason.
Well, fascinating. We shall see if that happens. Somehow, I doubt it. But anyway, the book, like I say, Layman's Guide to the English Constitution by Albert Burgess.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Now, Libya is done and dusted, but was it a just intervention? Some are saying NATO used depleted uranium weapons, and that we've also set a precedent for intervening in civil wars and even helping start civil wars. David Crouch works at the Financial Times and is also an anti-war activist. I spoke to him earlier in the year, this is a couple of months ago, whilst the Libyan conflict was still raging and NATO's intervention too.
My name's David Crouch. I'm a news editor at the Financial Times. The classic slogan of journalists is that the first casualty of any war is the truth. And I think that's really true when it applies to what's happening in Libya at the moment. I think that the British media has unfortunately been softening up the British public to persuade them to support military intervention in Libya, which I think is a big mistake.
But many people have been watching Gaddafi over the years, and he, you know, singling him out as a bit of a crazy guy, a dictator, and something needs to be done about him. And some of his own people, at least, have decided to do that. Surely we should be there to help them.
Well, certainly in the first few weeks of the uprising in Libya, which is so much an extension of the Arab Spring, the uprisings we've seen across North Africa and the Middle East, in the first few weeks, the Libyans themselves showed themselves very capable of taking things into their own hands and kicking out Gaddafi's henchmen. And they insisted in those first few weeks that they didn't want Western intervention, they didn't want another Iraq or another Afghanistan. Unfortunately, when the regime fought back and the rebels started to encounter their first defeats, then voices were raised in support of Western intervention. But I'm still completely convinced that the Libyans themselves, certainly with help from their comrades in North Africa, can sort the situation out for themselves.
We've also seen the Security Council, the United Nations, and we've seen the Arab League supporting this. So who are you to say that it shouldn't happen?
There are a lot of problems with that position. The Arab League itself represents many of the dictatorships that are under so much pressure at the moment in that part of the world. And as for the UN, okay, they've voted for a no-fly zone in Libya, but at the same time we're seeing scores of people being gunned down by their governments in Bahrain, in Yemen, in Syria, but no movement to intervene there, which suggests not just hypocrisy, but it suggests that the motives behind the military intervention in Libya are much, much more than protecting civilians. I would say they have actually nothing to do with civilians. They're much more about Western strategic interests in that part of the world.
So you're talking about oil?
I'm talking about oil, but actually, I think for Italy, for example, which receives 25% of its oil from Libya, yes, it is a matter of oil. But I think much more, this is about the oil-producing part of the world in turmoil, and the United States, Britain and the West looking to establish some control over the uprisings, the political turmoil in that part of the world, because it is so strategically important for them. So stability on their terms. And if you look at Iraq and Afghanistan, we know what those terms are. Those terms are letting the free market rip. They're nothing to do with establishing peace or democracy.
Now, you mentioned at the start you thought that the British press had been softening people up for Libya. Do you have any evidence for that?
Let's look at the Times newspaper, for example, owned by Rupert Murdoch. It has conducted a concerted campaign demanding Western intervention. Also, other newspapers like the London Evening Standard has campaigned to demand this intervention, accusing the British government, the American government, of being weak and vacillating and so on and so forth, printing all sorts of allegations about atrocities, massacres, with very little actual evidence when you look at the evidence. I have absolutely no sympathy for Gaddafi. I think he's a murdering swine and he needs to be overthrown. But the reports we had in the run-up to the intervention, for example, the Times printed on its front page that black African mercenaries for Gaddafi had been getting drunk and taking Viagra and raping oppositionists. Now, that was a single source, and we've seen no confirmation of that anywhere.
Finally, at the FT, your leader writer, being an ex-member of the Bullingdon Club.
It's not something that's particularly a secret, but I think there are disagreements, like in any newsroom, about how the West should respond to the Arab uprisings. But certainly some people in the FT are very close to the current UK government. I think that probably explains why my newspaper has come out so firmly in support of Western military intervention, which I disagree with. I think that's very unfortunate.
Well, the leader writer in question is Jonathan Ford. He's leader writer for the Financial Times, and there was David Crouch, who's one of the news editors or writers or subs, at least on the Financial Times. Martin, let's have a little bit of a take on this, because we've also heard news this week also that 50 Gaddafi supporters were executed. Human Rights Watch have been telling us this is by anti-Gaddafi fighters.
Yes, and a whole town north of Misrata, which was actually occupied largely by black Libyans from the Fulani tribe, has disappeared and has been razed to the ground, and the people inside it have disappeared. Now, in actual fact, there's no guarantee that the people who've taken over in Libya are any better or any worse than Gaddafi. Just like in Iraq, it's like the old saying that beggars may ride. As soon as the people that had been repressed by Saddam for years were given the whip hand, they turned out to be exactly the same as the people that had been oppressing them. And it's understandable. It's understandable. But the idea that our intervention has somehow brought freedom and democracy, there must be at least 30,000 people who've died in Libya over the last few months. And the war's not necessarily over. The Fulani tribe, which is the black Libyans, are mostly based in the south of Libya. That doesn't seem to be under the control of the regime at the moment. There is now potential fighting between the Islamic Fighting Group, who are in control of Tripoli, and other people who are in control of Benghazi. And the Islamic Fighting Group, of course, are Al-Qaeda Libya, and they've been working with MI6 since the 1980s. And that's what people should take away from what's going on here. Islamic fundamentalist terrorists are the allies of the Western intelligence services. They always were.
Now, the new Defence Secretary, Philip Hammond, has also been saying this week that British companies should go and head right now to Libya to get reconstruction
money. We're not doing this for our own benefit. We're doing it out of humanitarian impulse. That's all out the window then, is it? Surely it shouldn't matter to us who gets the reconstruction contracts. In actual fact, of course, the infrastructure of Libya has been bombed by the RAF and others so that we can go and get the contracts to rebuild, or not us. Certain people with well connected to our own power structure. Actually, Britain's not unlike Libya under Gaddafi, really, when you think about it, is it?
Well, also, just sticking with this
family connection,
sticking with this Bullingdon Club connection, there are many people in power right now, including Boris Johnson and George Osborne, who are part of this Bullingdon Club. And as we heard there again, probably many people have heard that for the first time. The Financial Times leader writer Jonathan Ford is part of this Bullingdon Club too. What do you think about that, Martin? Because it does seem that if you're part of this club when you were at Oxford, you have a kind of almost like a magic ticket to get into these powerful positions. And a leader writer on a newspaper is actually in a very powerful position, especially when they're mates with the Prime Minister.
Well, of course, we all know that there are circles of power in this country. There always have been. I mean, basically, there is a network of well-connected public schools like Eton, Oxford University, which I went to, but of course I didn't go to a well-connected public school and I wasn't part of the Bullingdon Club, and it's quite clear who runs this country. I mean, a large proportion, there is a ruling class, there always has been, and they're still there. They haven't gone away.
Okay, now, On the day changes to the accession to the throne are announced, we hear from a Jewish author, former of the US Navy, Tim Cohen, all about what he believes are corrupt orders of knighthood here in Britain, with possible satanic links that have been secretly tightening their grip on power for centuries. A Halloween story indeed, and not for the faint-hearted. Here's a man who's definitely taken the red pill. This is the author, T.
Tim Cohen to tell us more.
We have in this lineage of Prince Charles an individual who can one day step on the world scene and claim for himself royal hegemony to Jerusalem for all the major faiths that have historically vied for control of the city, for apostate Christianity in his claim to be descended from Jesus Christ, for Islam, a false religion, in his claim to be descended from Muhammad, for apostate Israel in his claim to descent from Israel's King David. And by the way, Queen Elizabeth II's official lineage, which I do offer through Prophecy House with the Antichrist and the cup of tea for those who decide to obtain it, shows over 15 separate descents from King David and Judah. It goes back some 2,500 years. Now we're going to come back to the lineage in a moment when we deal with the Mideast peace process. In the meantime, let's move forward. Whose power base is behind the New World Order? When we talk about the New World Order, people hear of a number of organs. They hear of Freemasonry, that it's important to the New World Order. They hear of the Illuminati, that it's key to the New World Order. They hear of the Knights Templar, that they have a role to play in the New World Order. They hear of the Priory of Zion, which gave us the protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion, that blasphemous document that was used to stir up so much hatred and persecution against Israel in this century, particularly by the Nazis, etc. What I have here on the screen is something that is called the Garter Badge. Notice the garter around it. This Garter Badge purports to be the Black Prince, the founding prince of the Order of the Garter, and the Order of the Garter was founded by Edward III, who was the King of England at the time, and Edward the Black Prince, who was the Prince of Wales of the day, in 1348. This is supposed to be the Black Prince praying before God the Father and the crucified Christ, and this is supposed to be Mary. That's the official explanation of the Garter Badge. However, notice that this woman is holding a cat and a frog. In other words, she is a witch. This Garter Badge is actually a badge that is given to new witch kings and witch queens in Wicca. To become a witch king or a witch queen, you have to have a coven of covens beneath you. A coven is when a high priest has 12 other witches beneath her, so she becomes a high priestess, or a man becomes a high priest in Wicca. When that same person actually has a coven of covens, in other words, 12 covens of witches, 12 other high priests and high priestesses beneath them, who are over their own covens, that witch, male or female, becomes either a witch king or a witch queen. What I want to show you is the garter on the coat of arms of Prince Charles to talk about the whole conspiracy of the New World Order. We're going to see more about that in a moment. This garter is the central symbol of the Order of the Garter. It has on it a motto that when translated into English means shame be to him who thinks ill of it, or evil be to him who thinks ill of it. This garter came when Edward the Black Prince picked up a garter that fell off of the Countess of Salisbury at a ball in the 1300s. That garter that fell off was a witch's garter. A high priestess in witchcraft wears a garter around her thigh that has a horseshoe-shaped buckle on it, roughly horseshoe-shaped, for every coven beneath her. So as a high priestess, she would normally have one horseshoe-shaped buckle. Instead of executing her, as Edward the Black Prince should have done under the law, he had her raised to a statue of prominence by picking up the garter and stating that he would make it an honorable symbol throughout all the world. And thus it became the central symbol of the Order of the Garter. Notice that this garter on the Prince of Wales coat of arms has two gold edges. In the real garter of the Order of the Garter, and I happen to have a photograph of one, these two gold edges are actually two rows of 169 gold buckles each, and they are horseshoe-shaped gold buckles. One row for the Prince of Wales of the day, and one row for the British monarch of the day, who are the two highest-ranking knights of the Order of the Garter by birth. 13 times 13 gold buckles for both the Prince of Wales, and then again for the British monarch. What that says in the occult world is that the Prince of Wales of the day is a witch king of witch kings, And the British monarch of the day is a which king of which kings, or in the case of the current queen, a which queen of which queens. A satanic parallel to the King of Kings that we read concerning Jesus Christ, Yeshua HaMashiach, in the New Testament. That means that the Order of the Garter, when it was founded in 1348, constituted the core leadership of organized witchcraft on earth. Today it also constitutes the core leadership of organized Satanism on earth. The documentation for that is provided in the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea, and in fact, the current royal family has participated in Satanism. But there's much more to it. In 1348, when the Order of the Garter was founded, it constituted the core leadership of something called the Priory of Zion, which existed to ensure the continuation of the Merovingian lineage, this lineage that claims descent from Jesus Christ, on the royal thrones of the houses, royal houses of Europe. Merovi, his descendants, were placed on the royal thrones of Europe through intermarriage over the ensuing centuries. Thus again, the British monarchy believes it's descended from Jesus Christ. Out of the Priory of Zion came the Knights Templar and the Rosicrucians. The Knights Templar were the bodyguards of the British monarchy during the Crusades, even before the Order of the Garter was formed. They are still the bodyguards of the British monarchy today, according to the British monarchy's own sources, and I have documented that in the Antichrist and the Cup of Tea. According to the monarchy, they are the oldest continuous armed bodyguard in the world.
That was Tim Cohen there with his take on what he believes are corrupt and secretive orders, not just of knighthood, but of occult power too. And for anyone interested in such subjects, you could do worse than check out the fiction and non-fiction works of Dennis Wheatley. Dennis served heroically as a wing commander in the Cabinet War Office during World War II, mainly as a deception planner, and he had it from the horse's mouth, so to speak, over dinner with the occultists of his day, such as the notorious so-called 666, Alistair Crowley, and also Bristol occult expert Montague Summers. Two of Dennis Wheatley's occult novels were made into films. They were The Devil Rides Out and To the Devil a Daughter, first of which is much better than the second one. There were plans also for Hammer Films to make a third called The Satanist from Dennis Wheatley's novel, but because of legal and financial problems, the second was the last horror film Hammer ever made. So, as for non-fiction, Wheatley's most useful book is probably The Devil and All His Works, published not long after his death in the mid-1970s. So, that's it for this week. Apologies we didn't have time for the piece on common purpose. We'll have that next week. That's all the serious talk out of the way. After the Sky News at 7, Friday night is Music Night. 2 hours live with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party crew. Next week, Green Councillor Gus Hoyt.
Listen live online at bcfm.org.uk. BCFM News from the Sky.